Welcome to Microdigressions. This is Spencer Case. And today's subject is relativism. This view might be being presupposed when somebody says something like, what's true for me may not be true for you, or there are no facts, they're just opinions. These are ambiguous sorts of statements, and it's one of the reasons they often annoy me when I see them in papers and that sort of thing. But one way to interpret them is as expressions of this view called relativism. Basically, the idea that in certain important domains of inquiry or discourse, there are no ultimate truths. There are just truths relative to perspectives or points of view. So that's the basic idea, very, very roughly. And here to discuss that with me is Rob Gressis. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Spencer?
I'm pretty good. How is the lockdown treating you these days? I should say Rob Gressis is a philosophy professor at California State University, Northridge. Is that right?
That's right.
And you did your PhD work, is it Michigan, Ann Arbor?
That's right.
Yeah, way too fancy for me.
Yep.
So how are things going these days?
Well, I just learned yesterday two things that are quite relevant to your question. One is that California's shelter-in-place orders have been extended to, I think, August 18th. And the other one is that California State University, the system of which my university is a part, has told us that almost all classes will be online next semester. So that's pretty big news on both fronts. And I'm myself not exactly, I think the online classes is a good idea, but I'm not sure how I feel about the shelter in place order until August 18th.
Yeah, that's pretty intense. I've been mostly dealing with some sort of social distancing or quarantine since February or January, in fact.
Oh, right.
In Wuhan.
That's right.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's a challenge to be a parent in times like this.
It is a challenge, but my son is very good natured. He's very happy. He seems to be easy enough to entertain. He does occasionally tell us that he misses playing with other kids. And if he could have any one thing, that would be it. But he's only acted out. There's only been one day where he's had a bad day during this entire time so far. So that's, you couldn't ask for more than that, really.
Yeah, no, that's pretty good, all things considered. I've been sort of hanging out in the cemetery next to my parents' house, because it's peaceful there and I can read outdoors. There aren't a lot of people around.
That makes sense.
And the ones who are around are 6 feet away from me underground. So I've got that covered.
That's a good one.
I'm not about to paint my nails black or anything like that.
No, you would be a terrible goth.
I would be a terrible goth, yeah. All right then. So to the matter at hand, it seems like when relativism is a topic, it's a very abstract sort of position. It's a little bit less abstract when it's applied to morality, but still fairly abstract. It would be in the domain of meta-ethics rather than the normative ethics, as philosophers would say. It does not deal directly with first-order moral issues, but it gets a lot of intense reactions out of philosophers. That's one thing I've noticed about it. Like a lot of philosophers, when they're teaching, well, especially ethics, but other things too, they feel like they really have to go out of their way to quash this view, nip it at the bud, this view that, well, who's to say? Because the worry then is that if you allow students to shrug and say, well, who's to say, or maybe it's abortion is right for you, but wrong for me, then that sort of short circuits all discourse. So certainly as a matter of pedagogy, it seems like a lot of philosophers take the stance that we're going to just crush this from the get-go and not even treat it as a view on the table to be considered. Is that your experience?
It's my experience of other philosophers when I say it's my experience of other philosophers, I don't mean to say that I sit in on a bunch of courses and hear how they teach relativism. But when I look at textbooks, it's almost always treated as a view to be overcome. So usually it'll be discussed early on in an ethics textbook, and it'll say, here's why you shouldn't be a relativist. Here are the negative consequences of relativism. And then it hopes, I suppose, that students will accept those arguments and move on, because it rarely gives counter arguments that relativists can give on in their own defense. It's actually really a funny thing. I can't think of too many other views that are brought up just to be dismissed in philosophy books, other than, say, psychological egoism and ethical egoism.
Yeah, but that's what that, or simple subjectivism is sometimes dismissed in this way. Or, I can maybe think of a few others that are basically toy views that are meant for pedagogical purposes, not to be seriously considered in their own right. Another thing I want to point out about relativism, though, is it seems actually to have filtered into the culture wars in a way other views on this level of abstraction have not. And mm-hmm. I think that either began with is it Alan Bloom's?
Alan Bloom, the closing of the
West. Closing of the American mind.
Yeah.
And I think 1987, 1988.
It was 87, yeah.
Okay. And the thought that this is one of the pernicious things about liberal universities is that they are breeding cultural relativism, which is interesting because it seems to me that might be true in some departments, but philosophers are trying to like smash it with a hammer and beat it out of their students. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that, being for the truth and standing for what the traditional university is supposed to stand for and some of the things conservatives are worried about is bound up with rejecting relativism, and not just rejecting it, but treating it as like kind of an enemy.
Almost. Yeah, that's true. I'll tell you, when I teach it, I used to be one of the philosophers you were describing before, where it would quite literally make me angry when students would invoke relativism as a way of, I saw it as getting out of an argument. And I also saw it as very confused. I would always press them whenever they said, it's true for me, but not for you. I would always press them and say, what's the difference between saying it's true for me versus I believe it? Is there any difference? Can something be false for you, but you believe it? Or is true for you just another way of saying you believe it and I don't, right? And so that's how I would treat it for a while. But then I'd say it's about the last 2 years, every time I talk about relativism, my point is that even if you're a relativist, it's still possible to have an ethical discussion. So I don't try to quash it. I try to say, don't use it as a way of getting out of arguments. It could be true. It could be the correct view. But even if it is the correct view, it doesn't mean we're done talking. Because, and then the example I give to them is take music. I'll say, look, a lot of you believe that music is subjective, that what's good is in the ear of the, not beholder, but hearer. But that doesn't stop you from having arguments about music. That doesn't stop you from arguing about who's the best band or which song is better than that song, even if on some level you think it's all subjective. And so I try to get them to think about ethical arguments, if they are relativists, and not all of them are, but if they are relativists, as being still things you can engage in.
You know, I'm curious to hear more about what you were thinking in the music example, mm-hmm. because I would want to say that certain musical albums are much better than others. I allow some sort of role for taste here. Like maybe jazz just isn't your thing. Mm-hmm. But if you like jazz, I think you should think that Kind of Blue is a very, very good album. And if, but I don't know, is that what you're thinking? That relative to one kind of art, something is better?
So what I tell them is that I try to tell them that a lot of them who think that art is in the eye of the beholder, they don't necessarily practice that when it comes to their daily lives. So I'll give the example. I'll say, if you like hip hop, it's going to be very hard for you to argue that Vanilla Ice is a better rapper than Kendrick Lamar. And I'll just say, you know, why is that? Like, explain to me, if you like Kendrick Lamar better than Vanilla Ice, why that is. And a lot of them haven't heard Vanilla Ice, but a lot of them have. They've heard Ice Ice Baby. And, you know, they'll say stuff, you know, like Kendrick Lamar's lyrics are more interesting, they're more authentic, his flow is better. that sort of stuff. And I'll say, great. So even if you think music is subjective, it could still be the case that it's really hard to argue for certain things as being worse or as being just neither better nor worse than others. And so I'll say, let's explore why that is in music. And so one thing I'll do is I'll try to get them to say, look, within music, there are certain standards for each kind of music. If you're trying to make good hip hop, there are certain things that you're aiming towards. And some people do a better job of reaching those goals than other people do. And so now the relativism might come in with, why are those the goals of hip hop, right? How did that happen? Is it the case that hip hop is better than classical music? Well, that might be really kind of impossible to argue for one way or the other, because what they're trying to do is something so different, even though they're both recognizably kinds of music. And even though they're both arguably trying to entertain or enchant the listener in some way, it's still the case that the way they have to go about doing that is different. So I'll sort of bring this up to them. And I find that it kind of makes the question of who are you to say sometimes go away a bit, because they feel comfortable that they can say that certain things are better than others without necessarily meaning that, without feeling intolerant. Maybe that's what I aim at anyway. But yeah, the other thing I aim at with that musical analogy is to show them how complicated this question is, because it seems very difficult to deny that Kendrick Lamar is better than Vanilla Ice. I've never had a student who denied it. Although you could say, you know, as a matter of fact, many people just prefer Kendrick Lamar because they're told to, right? There's this guy, I think his name is Bourdieu, who wrote this book called Taste, I think, where he talks about how much of high art is just a kind of class issue, that, you know, it's a way of showing that you are part of the class you want to be part of, and it doesn't really have anything to do with the intrinsic properties of the music. But again, even that's complicated. Even that brings up interesting things that are beyond just, this is my opinion, we're done talking.
Now, one reaction I've got to what you're telling me here is, I think that seems like a good way of proceeding, but it seems to me that in order to get genuine disagreement and genuine agreement on standards, you're not so much accepting relativism as you're positing a plurality of non-relative standards for smaller domains. You've taken the big domain, like what is good music. There's no absolute answer to that. But if you break it up into smaller chunks and you say, okay, what is good hip hop? What is good jazz? What is good classical music? Then in each one of those little domains, you've got absolute standards for each of them. Mm-hmm. Although you could say, well, I'm not doing hip hop. I'm doing something else. You know, I suppose Vanilla Ice could always say that, like, well, if you're evaluating me by the hip hop standards, but I'm actually doing something else, so it's unfair to evaluate me by those standards. And then maybe you're getting back to relativism.
Yeah. So I'll say two things about that. And actually I should say one thing, a kind of meta discursive point. I am not saying I am a relativist. I'm not saying I'm not either. I have this kind of view, and I don't know anybody else who has this view, which is that every commonly felt response is coming from somewhere important, to put it quite abstractly. So I'll give you an example in the philosophy setting. I run into relativism over and over and over again among my students. I think the fact that I run into it so often tells me that there's something real that it's the articulation of. It might not be the best way to articulate what they're really experiencing, but there's something they're trying to get at by being relativists. I'll give you another example. A lot of times when I talk about the problem of evil, a lot of students are very moved by the response that in order to even understand what good is, you have to first of all understand what evil is, right? And this is a response that very few philosophers have taken seriously. And I don't know anybody who uses that defense or that theodicy today. But I think it's probably got something going for it. And I like to explore that. And I think every political movement, no matter how extreme, if it commands enough attention, it's coming from some real place that deserves to be investigated. So this is all sort of by way of how I just look at issues, okay? So I don't want to make fun of relativism. I don't want to dismiss it easily, given that it keeps on cropping up. So that's one of the reasons why I moved to try to articulate it and try to find a more defensible version of it. That's the first thing. Second thing is, in regard to your earlier question about how I haven't really dispensed with truth, I've just had a lot of different truth domains. Well, what I want to say is that moral relativism is different from, say, emotivism or a nihilism, in that moral relativists say that certain moral claims are true. It's just they're true given certain other kinds of standards, right? Given that you've accepted, given, I don't even know if accept is the right word, but given that you're subject to these standards, these are the right moral, these are your moral obligations you have to have, these are the ways you have to behave. So I see relativism as a kind of in-between position between objectivism and subjectivism, or between objectivism and nihilism, in that it allows for truth, but it also says that there's not a single truth standard that you can use to resolve all debates. So it could be the case that within the American context, there are right and wrong answers to our moral questions. But when you go from the American context to, say, the Iranian context, the standards are different, and then there might be different answers to similar looking questions. And then when you're an American meeting an Iranian, then weird stuff starts to happen, which is basically you have to, like, new standards emerge from the interaction. And so to bring this back to the musical analogy, there can be two kinds of pluralism about truth. First of all, there's just comparing different genres of music to each other. It might be hard to argue that classical music is superior to rock and roll, just because they're so different, they're doing different things.
Roger Scruton doesn't think so, but
oh yeah, and I'm not saying that that's impossible.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and you know, I tend to be more objective about music than I think a lot of other people are. But that said, even if you do allow for different kinds of musical standards and pluralism about that, it could be that within a musical standard you can have innovation. So it could be the case that rock and roll was a certain way until perhaps the Pixies came along, and then they sort of changed the genre, and then they changed the standards. And that's probably true with any genre of music. If I knew music better, I could give more concrete examples, but I don't.
Yeah, so I think it's right that to have moral relativism, you can still have progress, but you can have progress within different sets of values.
Yeah, and I should say, if you want, I can talk about what it is I find compelling about relativism and how I imagine it too.
Well, I want to get back to this and get into the nitty-gritty of moral relativism, but I wanted to back up and, you know, define some of this more precisely.
Okay.
So what is relativism in general? And, you know, I actually find that this is quite difficult to cash out mm-hmm. with any degree of specificity, at least to my satisfaction. Yeah. And I'll tell you why. So I'm going to read the beginning of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy article on relativism and then make a comment on it. I'm interested to hear what you'll say. So this is what the article says. It says, relativism, roughly put, is the view that truth and falsity, right and wrong, standards of reasoning, and procedures of justification are products of differing conventions and frameworks of assessment, and that their authority is confined to the context giving rise to them. More precisely, relativism covers views which maintain that, at a high level of abstraction, at least some class of things have the properties they have, e.g. beautiful, morally good, epistemically justified, not simpliciter, but only relative to a given framework of assessment. And it goes on from there, but that's, I think, enough. So the one thing I'm wondering about this is, why can't there be relativism about all sorts of trivial things, given that description? So, for example, it is 1:19 p.m. for me, and it is 12:19 p.m. for you, because I'm in Mountain Standard Time and you're on Pacific Time. Is that what time it is, relativism? Because it seems like that is a domain of truth, what time it is. It's a very narrow domain of truth, mm-hmm. Where it's framework dependent. But yet, my reaction is to think, no, that's too trivial. That's not relativism. It's too easily resolved. It's too easily explained away. But maybe it's just an uninteresting kind of relativism. What do you think?
That's really interesting. I had never thought of that as a kind of relativism. My first instinct is to say, I don't know whether that's relativism. But if it is relativism, I don't see what the problem would be exactly. Like, I will say this. Imagine, like, one kind of relativism I find confuses me is relativism about the taste of food. When I say this chicken tastes good, or whatever, actually, I shouldn't use that example with you. When I say this eggplant tastes good, I will say, you know, I must mean, I think, that it tastes a certain way to me. And that if it tastes differently to you, then I'm not saying you're wrong. That would be weird for me to say. I would say, okay, I guess you just don't like the taste of that. And so, like, is that a relativism about how eggplant tastes? No, I guess that's just two people having different experiences, right? The relativism that's most naturally relativistic to me is relativism about legal obligations. Because here we have almost explicitly written down systems that say what your obligations are. And then you can just sort of look at where they have application and say, oh, I'm in this domain, so here are my legal obligations. If I go to this other domain, I have different legal obligations. What's illegal here might be legal there. Now, here's the thing. It's a fact that, let's say, it's a fact that taking marijuana in California, smoking marijuana in California is legal, and it's a fact that smoking marijuana in Japan is illegal. Do you think that counts as relativism, like a legal relativism? Like, clearly, the legal obligation changes depending on which country you're in.
Yeah, in fact, Gilbert Harman, who's one defender of moral relativism, explicitly uses this analogy with law. Mm-hmm. He says there are different moralities just as there are different languages and different legal systems.
Yeah. And what's interesting, and actually Harman is one of the relativists I read who I think is pretty interesting on this, because one of the things he talked about in one of his articles on relativism is that if I'm having a moral debate with you, my contemporary, I will know what sort of things to bring up if I'm criticizing you or if I'm defending myself from your criticisms. But he said, imagine that you're arguing with Hitler. You just wouldn't go about the argument in the same way. It would almost seem silly to bring up the kinds of things that you find morally objectionable in a conversation with Spencer that you would with Hitler. Now, I don't know if this proves anything. I don't think it does, but it was an example where I felt as though there's some truth there, because when I think about people in the distant past, it feels strange to me to criticize them by our current categories. Now, that could just be that they still did lots of wrong stuff. It's just that they're not culpable because they didn't know enough. That's one way to go about it. So it's really it's not relativism. It's just, it has to do with praise and blame and not what they actually are and aren't obligated to do. Another way to go about it is that they literally were obligated to do different things, but that's simply because their situation was different. And that if we were in their situation, we'd have to do those things. So there is a fact of the matter that moves from situation to obligations. But it's also possible to explain this feeling, if you have that feeling, that maybe they literally did have different obligations because they had these different codes they'd all kind of agreed to. And in Harman's view, agreement seems to be key. He seems to say that morality arises from agreements that people make. And it's not explicit agreements, but it's a kind of agreement based on expectations and how they resolve cooperation games, and that they could have resolved them differently. So they could have had different agreements. So the fact that you have this set of agreements means you really have to abide by them, but they could have been different. So you could have had to really abide by other things. And I thought that has something going for it. I don't know how to resolve this debate, but I think that has something going for it.
Well, I would want to know more about the because, what kind of because this is. Because I would want to say, I think that makes sense if we're talking about different standards or different circumstances. Like, for example, if you inherit a slave plantation in the American South before the Civil War, mm-hmm. what you are to do is not that easy. You are actually in quite a difficult situation if you're of the opinion that slavery is wrong, because you can't just let them go. You have to legally manumit them, and that's quite expensive. And you're going to get a lot of suspicion for doing it. And it's not clear that there's any way for you to maintain your livelihood. And you might actually fear that if you don't crack the whip, there might be some kind of rebellion against you. I mean, you might find yourself in a very difficult position just given the terrible situation you've inherited with this.
Yeah.
So I think judging that person by a different standard than somebody today who goes out with a gun and kidnaps a bunch of people and forces them to work in his garden or something. I think that makes sense for reasons that are independent of relativism. But if Harman wants me to abstract away from those sorts of considerations and also considerations about ignorance, mm-hmm. this person might have been deeply indoctrinated in a racist ideology, then I'm not sure what's left to be accounted for once we've abstracted from those things. I think those considerations tend to diffuse that intuition nicely, for me anyway.
Yeah. I don't think he can say that they prove his intuitions. I think I can certainly see you having those intuitions and just saying what I said earlier, that it's about praise and blame, not moral obligation, or that it is about moral obligation. It's just that the person's moral obligations were different simply because of the context. And if we were in the same context, our moral obligations would be the same. And so there is a fact of the matter. But like I said, it was what first got me taking relativism more seriously. But the kind of relativism that I find most intriguing, and I think this has something to do with, I forgot his first name. I think is it David Wong?
Yeah.
David Wong's relativism. And there's also David Kopp. He has a relativism too, that are sort of similar lines. Like my route to relativism, and I'm not saying I'm a relativist, to repeat that, but the kind of relativism I find interesting is the imagining results from asking the question, in virtue of, like, what makes it the case that I have a moral obligation, right? What grounds it? And you can take your view, which is you're a non-naturalist moral realist about it. And then you can say something like an abstract object grounds it. I take it as what you're saying.
Yeah, I guess that's what I would want to say.
Yeah, that's one thing you can say. But I have to confess, I find the whole abstract objects ground thing to be quite mysterious. And now just because something's mysterious doesn't mean it's not true. It's quite possible that that there are abstract objects and they explain why certain things are true or false. And that's the end of the issue. But I kind of want more than that. And I sort of feel if we can explain why a moral statement is true or false in a way that makes sense to us, then I'm happier about that. At least if I can keep what, you know, other features of moral discourse. And so the kind of relativism I find intriguing would go like this. There's this guy, Michael Smith. I'm not sure, but I bet you've read him, The Moral Problem. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he tries to ground a form of moral realism that goes like this. What makes the case that you have an obligation to do X is that if a fully informed version of you were to look at the situation, that fully informed version of you would recommend you do, or would say you ought to do so-and-so, right? So basically, you with full information is what grounds your moral obligations. So it's a kind of ideal judge theorist or an ideal observer theory or something like that. And this involves modal considerations, or if not, you know, other possible worlds, right? What would I be like if I had perfect information? And we don't have access to that fact, but I feel like that to me doesn't seem very mysterious. I could just, you know, imagine myself getting more and more and more knowledge until I've sort of like reached the top, as it were, of my knowledge. And then with that knowledge, I would have certain reactions. And then it's those reactions that make it the case that I have certain moral obligations. Now, what's interesting to me about Smith is that although he's, I guess, classed as a moral realist, one of the things he says in The Moral Problem is that it's quite possible that different people, when fully informed, would reach different conclusions, would have different reactions. And if that happens, then they truly do have different moral obligations because they have these different reactions. So it's these reactions that ground our moral obligations. And what I'm imagining for moral relativism is that I don't think of morality as a solitary enterprise. I think of it as fundamentally having to do with how people relate to each other. And so I can imagine a kind of cultural relativism according to which there's a, for lack of a better word, and I know this might be rather mysterious, but I'm just starting to explore this. There could be kind of a fully informed version of a culture, And what that culture would do determines what the members of that culture's obligations are. And the way I think of it is like this. Think about interpreting the Constitution. Think about if you're an originalist. And if you're an originalist, of the kind that, say, Akhil Rita Marr or John Roberts is, what you'll say is that the Constitution enunciates certain principles, and because these principles were like agreed upon by the drafters, those are the laws. But sometimes it's not obvious what the principles commit us to, and we can make discoveries about what the principles commit us to. And it could be the case that there might be certain indeterminate areas where there's no fact of the matter about what the principles commit us to. It's just that you have to go down one path or another path. And then if you go down one path, that sort of creates a new set of moral obligations or, in this case, legal obligations. And so I'm imagining the same kind of thing for a culture, that there are certain values every culture has developed over time. And those values might be in conflict with each other. And it might take a long time for us to see the conflicts. But when we see the conflicts, we've got to go down one path or another to resolve the conflicts. And whichever path we happen to end up choosing, that now makes new principles that might emerge in response to new developments in technology or whatever. So that's the kind of culture relativism I kind of imagine. To me, that, although I know to some people that's going to seem equally mysterious to non-natural moral realism, to me it seems less mysterious. And it also has the advantage of making it the case that certain things are true or false.
Well, a couple of things here. One is that Michael Smith, it's been a good while since I read his book, The Moral Problem, but I remember that a key feature of it is that he expected there to be convergence among fully formed rational agents at the end of inquiry.
He did, but he also was open to the possibility that there might not be.
Okay, but for him, you wouldn't get realism in that case.
Although if it happened that every fully informed rational agent converged on the same reactions, right? That to me, and I bet to him, would be some evidence that there's some fact of the matter here, maybe. Or, you can't quite say that, because like if they all converge, you do want to ask, why are they converging?
I mean, I think it would just show that we were evolutionarily similar or something like that.
Yeah, maybe it's a sentimentalism or something.
So I guess we're going to hit on the queerness objection briefly. I find mysterious why anybody thinks the mysterious objection is compelling, but I guess it's something I've got to contend with, that lots and lots of people do have this reaction to non-naturalist moral realism.
Can I elaborate a little bit about that?
Okay, go ahead.
Well, no, if you had another point to say.
Yeah, I was going to make one more point.
Okay.
So Chris Heathwood has got this really interesting paper called Could Morality Have a Source at the Journal of Ethics and Social Philosophy. Open access, so you can just Google it. I think it's very interesting. There are a couple of moves he makes, and I'm like, I'm going to have to think about that a little bit. But he thinks that, like, for any cognitivist view, there's going to be some moral fact that has no source. So he begins with the example of divine command theory. Mm-hmm. So he says, so suppose that you think that murder is wrong because God forbids it. That is the reason.
Yeah.
He says, what about the fact that something is wrong if and only if God forbids it? So the divine command theory itself, mm-hmm. did God command that? And he says, well, that would take you off onto a vicious regress. And I suppose somebody could say, why couldn't God do it? You know, an infinite series of commands or something like that. But then you can do this sort of move with other sorts of views, like constructivism. If rational agents construct, you know, such and such a system, then it would be binding, and it would constitute morality. And then you get these oughts. Well, Heathwood would say that the basic fact that if you have these conditions being realized in a community, then such and such is your moral obligation. That seems like a normative fact that's just basic. And so his claim is that you can get this with everything. And so that kind of is a response to your worry about mysteriousness or whatever, because it might just be non-negotiable to have something basic like that in there. But it also connects to this debate about relativism, and I think complicates it, because I'm not entirely sure how we distinguish moral realism from relativism, if Heathwood is right about this, right? Because it seems like you've got just this basic fact that if your culture agrees about such and such, then you've got such and such moral obligations. And that fact is not constructed by your culture. So it seems like we're a realist, at least about that fact at the most general level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I was going to say sort of relates to that. And that has to do with what it means to find something mysterious.
Yeah.
And one of the suspicions I have is that the more acquaintance you have with philosophy, and in particular metaphysics and epistemology and these sort of so-called core areas, the more you have like familiarity with moves about, you know, when facts are or are not like permissively invoked and whether or not everything needs to be grounded and not. And I don't have that much familiarity with metaphysics, so I don't know how those grounding debates have gone. If it's the case that most people have moved on from my sense of mysteriousness, I'd love to read about that, because I'm open to the possibility that my sense of queerness you're talking about, that the fact that this is queer, that could just be a psychological reaction. Maybe all sorts of things that I take for granted, other people could look at and say, that's queer. I don't understand that. And I remember you had a debate with Dan Kaufman on Blogging Heads TV. And one of the things that kept on happening between you two is he kept on professing not to understand what you were talking about. And you kept on wondering why he didn't understand. And at least that's how I remember it. And
parts of it were like that.
Yeah. And so, but let's talk about this. So if I say to you that, it's a fact that if a culture has certain standards and that culture is fully informed, then those standards make it the case that people have moral obligations. That's just a fact. What kind of fact is that? Like, is there an answer to that question? What kind of fact is that? Are there different kinds of facts?
I would say that seems like a normative fact to me.
Mm-hmm. It's a normative fact. So basically, because if I said to you, it's a fact that all first order moral statements are false, is that a normative fact too, on your view?
No, I would not think so. I would not think so.
Because the first thing I would think is that maybe a similar move can be made by the relativists, that fact is not a normative fact. It's a non-normative fact that describes just how moral obligations come into existence. So I'm reminded of this book by Robert Adams, Finite and Infinite Goods. And what Adams does, Adams defends divine command theory in that book. And what he says is that we have a concept a concept of morality. And according to this concept, moral standards are universal, they're binding, and, you know, there's so on and so forth. So what could ground moral obligations, right? What's the best fit? And he thinks if there is a God, then being commanded by a loving God is the best fit for morality. So he makes this analogy between water and H2O. You know, we have water as phenomenologically experienced, and then we look for its chemical composition. What best fits the thing that we phenomenologically experience as water? And the answer is H2O. And he says, similarly, morality has a certain phenomenological feel to us. What kind of thing, if it were real, would best make sense of that phenomenological feel? He talks about being commanded by a loving God, but then he says second best would be something like Scanlon's view. Although I remember Scanlon invoking sort of brute reasons itself, so I don't know how much that helps, but that's what Adams says. So it could be that culture relativism is just a best fit. Like, that's what makes it a fact, that it's the best fit for how we talk about morality, what our moral practices are, why when people sort of meet people from different cultures, they have the reactions they do, and they have to kind of build up a new sort of moral system for dealing with those cultures. So that'd be one way of justifying or explaining the fact of culture relativism.
Yeah. So it seems to me that the kind of explanation that is often demanded of realists sort of actually just removes it from the stage, right? Like, if I have If my moral duties are explained in terms of my inclinations, mm-hmm. I don't really know what that means if it isn't a kind of error theory, to be honest. And that might sound striking because Smith considers himself a realist, but you know, when I think that like I ought not to hurt people for my enjoyment, mm-hmm. I don't feel as if what I'm saying is I'm expressing my inclinations in some way, or even that I'm expressing what I would want if I were fully informed, or, you know, add whatever purely descriptive bells and whistles
yeah.
I want. I have a very strong sort of sense that something is slipping through the cracks here in that proposed reduction. So I would want to say that if it turns out that when I say, let's say, slavery is morally wrong, actually the correct account of that is slavery is morally wrong relative to my culture, which fleshed out means that, you know, there's a certain set of descriptive facts that obtain in my culture according to which slavery is disapproved of. I would say that's an error theory. And I actually think this is the more fundamental problem for moral mm-hmm. relativism. I mean, one way of arguing against it, and the down and dirty way of arguing against moral relativism, is like a reductio ad absurdum, like what Mary Midgley does. Like, would it be wrong for was it wrong in ancient Japan, or no? I guess it would be medieval Japan, for samurais to test out their swords on innocent people. Mm-hmm. And we want to say yes. And so that's like a bullet to bite for relativism. And I think that's a pretty compelling argument. But I'm actually been thinking about another kind of argument, which is to say, if we really flesh out what this view means, why doesn't it just amount to an error theory, right?
So let me sort of see if I understand your objection. So Korsgaard has this view, right, that things are valuable only in being valued. If there were no valuers, nothing would have value. And then Don Regan criticizes Korsgaard because he says, look, this is not our experience of value. When we value something, we don't think to ourselves, oh, this is valuable because I value it. In fact, we say the reverse. We say, I value it because it has these features, right? And so I find these features of this thing attractive, and that's why I value it. And so it's really the features that make it valuable, nothing to do with our valuing, right? And so when you say an error theory, And the reason you called it an error theory is that you said it involved people's reactions, like even perfectly well-informed standards of reactions. Like if the only reason slavery is wrong is that a culture disapproves of it, then that's an error theory. Because when you experience slavery as wrong, you're not thinking to yourself, this is wrong because I disapprove of it. The direction goes the other way. You disapprove of it because it's wrong. Is that the thought that... that relativism gets the order of explanation wrong, or at least this version of relativism gets the order of explanation wrong, and that's why it's an error theory?
I'm not sure that's exactly it. That's not, okay. Because I wouldn't want to say that, like, hedonism about value is an error theory about value. I don't know that it's about dependence. It's more that if what I mean by slavery is morally wrong just amounts to some descriptive fact about my cultural environment, seems like, well, why not just do away with the normative statements about what's wrong and talk about this in the terms that like an anthropologist would. Mm-hmm. Like seasonal warfare is accepted in this community or what have you. Whereas I don't think that Korsgaard would want to say that we can get rid of all of the value talk and just talk about what agents have pro attitudes towards without any loss of, you know, any descriptive metaphysical loss there as far as our description of reality. I think what she would want to say is that there's something really substantively important about values, about having these sorts of attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, like, it might be a condition for objective values to exist that agents have to value things. But now we have something new in the world. Now we have value where there wasn't value before. There wasn't value when we had just asteroids and nebula and stuff like that. Whereas So if the relativist is saying that, like, oh no, the fact that my culture disapproves of slavery, like, makes it wrong. Mm-hmm. That sounds like it's a kind of wonky moral realism to me. It's a moral realism that makes implausible first order claims. Whereas if it's saying the other thing, if it's saying that these moral claims just amount to claims about what my community thinks or whatever, I would want to say, well, that's an error theory.
Yeah. So let me see if I understand that. Imagine that, and this is sometimes given as an objection to moral relativism. Imagine that you and I are in the same culture and we're arguing about whether or not eating meat is morally permissible. And I say, as long as it's not factory farmed, it is morally permissible. And you say, even if it's not factory farmed, it's still morally forbidden. One thing we could do is just take a survey of the average American and see what do they think. And probably they'll agree with me. And so the debate is settled. But that's not how a debate happens, obviously. That would be not compelling to you at all. You'd say, well, they shouldn't think that. It doesn't matter that they do. And what I want to say is, I guess the kind of relativism I find somewhat more plausible is one that says each culture has within it starting points for how it thinks people ought to reason. I don't quite know how they got there, but there are these points that people have about how they reason, like it just developed. And one of the things in our culture is that most of us seem to accept the norm. It is immoral to inflict terrible suffering on a sentient being for a trivial pleasure. And given that we accept that norm, we ought to reason to the conclusion that it's not permissible to kill and eat an animal, even if you do it humanely. Okay. And so then the question becomes, like, what norms, I suppose, does our culture accept? And then once it's accepted those norms, there are certain facts about how it ought to reason from those norms. And it's those facts that we can appeal to when we're trying to figure out what we should do in this debate. Now,
hold on.
Okay.
Are those facts independent of the framework? Are they within it?
So let's take, for instance, the fact that I articulated earlier. In the American context, let's say, we accept the norm. It's wrong to inflict terrible suffering on a sentient being for the sake of a trivial pleasure. Then you look to see whether the case of killing an animal humanely is a case of inflicting terrible suffering on an animal for a trivial pleasure. Now, are you asking, is it a fact whether or not this case is an instance of the norm or is a case to which the norm applies? Is that what you're asking? Or are you asking whether the norm itself is? Because I was going to say the norm itself is a fact just within our culture because we accept it or we accept something that entails it.
Well, for instance, I didn't know if what you were suggesting is that a relativism with regard to first order norms could allow a kind of non-relativism view about how we proceed with disagreement. Right.
Yeah, I mean, like, I would say you could be a non-relativist about entailment relations, right?
Well, not just that, that seems too weak, but I would agree with you.
But about say that you're agreeing with
I mean, I would agree with you about you could think that substantive moral norms are matters of cultural convention or dependent on cultural convention, but that like logic isn't. That I accept. But when I talk about like a methodology for disagreement, I mean more than like what entails what. I mean how we go about resolving our disagreements. Could somebody within a culture just kill off all of the opposing people so now I have a majority?
So that's an interesting question because I presume that killing off all the people in a culture and leaving the ones behind who agree with you only, I'm guessing that in that culture, whatever culture it is, that act itself will have violated a norm that people will have accepted or should have accepted given some other norms they accept. And so
probably, but like not logically necessarily, or there could be some other kind of underhanded way that they just they don't even have a norm about because no one even thought about it.
So I guess I would say, I want to make a point because we're sort of running low on time. You can be a moral relativist without being a value relativist, right? It could be the case that you're a relativist about moral obligations, but an objectivist about values. That's a view that I think is logically possible. It might be the case that anybody who believed one is going to believe the other just because the kinds of reasons they give for being a relativist about moral obligations are going to be very similar to the kinds of reasons they'd have to give to be a relativist about values as well. But if it's the case, for instance, that let's just say health is a value, right? That healthiness or not, right? There could be a fact of the matter about what is or isn't healthy. And then the question becomes, well, what are our moral obligations in relation to health facts? And that might be something that result from our agreements, as Harman would say, or however we got that these just norms emerge just through cultural interactions of various sorts. So I guess I would say that in theory, what you're saying is possible. And so what would happen is that I guess there could be a society where killing everybody who disagrees with you wouldn't violate any moral norm because they didn't accept any such moral norm. And then you did it. Did you do it in this case because you were trying to get the norms you endorsed to become majority norms? Is that what you did?
Right, not just the majority norms, the correct norms.
Right. So, well, yeah, I mean, I'd want to see a concrete example of this culture. But I will say this. I will say the fact that this is conceivable gives me a lot of pause, right? I find it a weird outcome if you can make it the case that something that was once wrong now is right because everybody who thought it was wrong is dead by your hand.
And more than in a purely descriptive sense, right?
In a prescriptive sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess part of what I would say is that like there are certain sentiments that I'm guessing are widespread enough in human cultures that norm would never emerge. It would never happen that people would accept this norm that says it's okay to kill most people in a culture because they're part of your culture, right? There are probably some cultures that some anthropologist has found somewhere, right? Like Mary Midgley's article that you mentioned, Trying Out One's New Sword, is often paired with Ruth Benedict's article about cultural relativism. And Ruth Benedict was an anthropologist who was writing in a time when they were finding all sorts of like offbeat cultures, to put it in a way that may or may not be offensive, but just cultures that were very small and did things extremely differently from the vast majority of other cultures we were familiar with. And that resulted, say, in norms of like lying to people was seen as good in some cultures and being trusting was seen as quite foolish, right? But then, you know, you learn more about this culture and you learn that it was constantly victimized by famine. And it was a sort of thing where there was never enough resources to meet all the people. And so you have explanations as to why that norm might have emerged. The norm of being a liar as a good thing.
And perhaps even rationalizations or justifications that others would accept.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say, you know, like I said at the beginning, I'm not a moral relativist, but I'm not a moral relativist. I'm trying to figure out what to think about it. But like part of the other motivation is just like global relativism in general. One of the questions I have as a philosopher has to do with something that looks, I suppose, at first to be somewhat unrelated, but I think is related. It goes to the free will debate. Whenever people are arguing for compatibilism or incompatibilism, and I find myself intuitively drawn to incompatibilism, whenever I find people arguing about that, I always wonder what makes it the case that one side would be right in this debate? Like, why would compatibilism end up being true? Or why would incompatibilism end up being true? What is it just like, what are the average person's reactions to like thought experiments? Is that what's going to make it the case? Or is it, I don't know what else it could be though. And if it's just the average person's reactions to thought experiments, I'm not sure that is a good ground because.
Seems like you're confusing metaphysics and epistemology there, right? Like the intuition is just the epistemic ground, not the metaphysical one.
Well, what's the metaphysical ground of compatibilism as being true or false?
Well, I think once again, like what Heathwood was saying in this article, there's some metaphysical facts.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you could say no ground. I suppose you could say that. What's the difference between a brute fact and no ground? I don't really know.
I mean, I guess Yeah, I guess it would be the difference between non-grounded and self-grounded or something like that. Yeah, but like...
Not my Ken. Don't know what you're talking about, but maybe there is such a distinction, but...
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah, like, I feel like there are... Maybe I exist would be something that's self-grounded, right? It's true anytime it's uttered because in order to be uttered, it has to be true kind of thing.
No, I would think your existence would be the ground of the truth.
I exist? Okay. All right. Yeah, fair enough. So there might be some statements, though, that in uttering them, they might be self-grounding. I have to think more about that.
This is a statement.
Yeah, that might be a good one.
Maybe.
Yeah. But yeah, anyway, the point is that what this debate leaves me wondering is like how to think about those kinds of grounds that Heathwood is talking about, right? Because part of me finds myself wanting to say, gosh, if it's just a brute fact, I kind of once again don't understand it anymore. And then the question I have is my feeling of not understanding itself relevant? Like, does it matter that I don't understand it? Or is it just psychologically contingent? And maybe if I were raised differently, I wouldn't have that feeling. But I don't feel it is psychologically contingent. I feel like it's real, and I feel like it's real because you just have to say this is a fact and you can't say why. It just is a fact. And I just now want to know about the ontology of those facts, because I suppose if I had an answer to that, then I could get clearer on whether or not there's good reason to move to moral relativism or not, right? It might be that the case really is that you can't have constructivism and you can't have moral relativism. Basically, it ends up being just kind of moral realism, kind of based on just facts and they're groundless, or you're the kind of person who is uncomfortable with those facts and you have to say that it's all subjective.
I'm inclined to think that there is no middle ground here, but that's just what I think. But I'm agreeing with you in where you're going with this, in saying that pushing this kind of debate does lead us to these kinds of questions and the sort of paradox that it's weird to think that there could be just these brute facts, and yet, you know, we also think explanations have to come to an end, and that's why regresses are bad. And so, you know, you're kind of left with something that you're going to feel that something's mysterious no matter what. Mm-hmm.
Also, if you do end up accepting that there are these brute facts, which one is the brute fact? Because I feel like if you're a divine command theorist and you said, well, the fact that God commands you to do X makes the case, and somebody says, but why? And I say, just a fact. And then they say, but how about it's just the case that you've got to do it, whether or not God commands it? And I'd say,
yeah, exactly.
Well, and then I'd say, well, I don't know how to decide between these two.
Yeah.
Why is one better than the other? And so, like, if there's a fact somewhere, how do you figure out which one it is?
Yeah. But see, I like to make that point because people complain that realism doesn't give you enough of an explanation. We can somehow get under it. But if I can say, wait a minute, we're left with something just mysterious, just as mysterious with that, I think that's an interesting response to some of these objections. But anyway, I see we're running short on time, and you've been very patient, and you've worked with me through some technical difficulties, and you were much more patient with that than I was. But I didn't know if you had any closing thoughts on this topic.
I have closing thoughts, but they might be the kinds that start to raise a lot of questions you want to chase. I will say this. I see a lot of the responses in textbooks to moral relativism as basically being exercises in begging the question. A lot of times they'll say stuff like, if moral relativism is true, then there's no such thing as moral progress, just to take that as an example. And my reaction to that is always one of two things. One, you could say, yeah, that's the point, right? That moral relativists know that. And that's just sort of saying, but it goes against realism. That doesn't mean it's false. It just means, okay, yeah, it has a consequence. But the other one, and the one I find more attractive, is that even if moral relativism is true, there could still be moral progress, right? If it is indeed the case that moral relativism just is, there are certain facts that every culture accepts, and then you reason on the basis of these facts to new conclusions, a culture could reason poorly from the facts they accept. They could accept this fact and not and think it leads to one thing, when really, if they were more clear-headed about it, they would realize it leads to another. And then once they finally realize it leads to another, that's a kind of moral progress, even though there's moral relativism. So I guess my closing fact is that I think a lot of the arguments against moral relativism aren't very good. And really where we should go is into the question of what grounds are moral obligations. And I think personally, that's why I might find moral relativism compelling in the first place. So that's it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Rob. It's been an excellent discussion. I hope to have you on again sometime.
I'd love to do it.
Okay. Well, take care.
Okay. Bye, Spencer.